With 1 Peter chapter 1, beginning at verse 3. It says, "Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, who according to his great mercy has caused us to be born again, to come alive from the dead, to a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead." This morning I want to talk to you about what Peter called a living hope, made possible through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead. It's a hope for the past. It's a hope for this present moment right here as we speak. And it's a hope for the future. And it's not just a hope for the distant future. The someday God will make it right. That's often how we think of hope, is someday he'll make everything right. And that's true. But it's more than that. It's a hope for the immediate future. A hope for tonight. A hope for tomorrow. The next day, next week, next month, next year, so on and so forth. A living hope made possible to each one of us through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead. And to illustrate that, I want to share a story from the life of Peter, found in John 21, a famous story where Jesus appeared to his disciples after his resurrection on the Sea of Galilee. But before I get to that story, I want to do a quick rewind, a flashback to a not-so-great moment in Peter's recent past that leads to what we're going to read about. The moment I'm referencing is about 5 weeks prior to the story we'll read in John 21. It took place on that famous Thursday night, the night before Jesus went to the cross when he was betrayed. Jesus and his disciples, if you remember, they had just enjoyed a meal together. And they had broken bread together. And Jesus was then beginning to explain a little more plainly about what was about to go down. How he would be betrayed and how they as sheep would be scattered and all the rest. And it's here in this little conversation. Well, let me quote what Jesus said. Mark 14:27. Jesus said to them, "You will all fall away because it is written, I will strike down the shepherd, and the sheep will be scattered." Now, Peter took exception to that comment. And it's at this moment that Peter makes his famous declaration, his boast of loyalty to the Lord. Mark 14:29. "But Peter said to Jesus, even though all may fall away, yet I will not." 31, Peter kept saying insistently, "Even if I have to die with you, I will not deny you." Now, I don't think anybody here would doubt Peter's sincerity or his how much he meant it when he made this great boast to the Lord. But Peter didn't realize the weakness of his own flesh. So he makes this boast, and here's how Jesus responds to him. Mark 14, verse 30. Jesus said to him, "Truly I say to you, this very night before a rooster crows, you yourself will deny me 3 times. Now, this prediction from Jesus to Peter must have shocked him to hear that, and probably even offended him. He never would have believed this possible, that he would betray the Lord in such an awful and horrible way. But sure enough, just a few hours later, right after Jesus is arrested and he's being brought to trial, Peter and some others follow at a distance to kind of check it out and see what's going to happen. Let's pick it up. John 18, verse 18. "Now the slaves and the officers were standing there having made a charcoal fire, for it was cold and they were warming themselves, and Peter was also with them standing and warming himself." I want you to make a mental note of this charcoal fire, because this will come back later. But just make a note of it for now, and listen to Luke 22, verse 56. "And a servant girl, seeing him as he sat in the firelight and looking intently at him, said, 'This man was with him too.' But Peter denied it, saying, 'Woman, I do not know him.'" So for those of you keeping your scorebook at home, make a note of that. I don't know. Don't know who he is. That's strike one. Okay, make a note. Then a second guy comes up and approaches Peter, says, "You're one of them. You're one of those Jesus freaks, aren't you?" Mark 14, verse 70, but again, Peter denied it. Strike two. That's two. Now, Peter better choke up on the bat, right? You got two strikes. We're not doing very good here. But then a short time later, a whole group of people comes up, and they begin to talk to Peter. Listen to Matthew 26, verse 73. A little later, the bystanders came up and said to Peter, "Surely you too are one of them, for even the way you talk gives you away." And Peter began to curse and to swear, and he said, "I do not know the man." Just a few hours earlier, imagine that. He's boasting before the Lord, talking about his loyalty, his willingness to die. Everybody else will fade away, but I will die for you. I'll give up my life. And then a couple hours later, I never heard of the guy. I don't know who you're talking about. Never bleepity bleep. He's cursing and swearing up a storm, furious. Never heard of the guy. And what happened next would haunt Peter for a long time, because as soon as those words left his lips, something awful happened for him. Matthew 26, 74, it says, "Immediately a rooster crowed. And Peter remembered the word which Jesus had said, 'Before a rooster crows, you will deny me three times.' And he went out and he wept bitterly." For Peter, this would be a night never to be forgotten, and for all the wrong reasons. If you know Peter's story in his life, you know his journey was a lot of ups and downs in his journey. But this has to be the lowest of all the lows for Peter. He screwed this one up royally, badly. He betrayed the Lord. He messed this whole thing up. And the worst part about it all is that the Lord knew it. Not only did Jesus predict what was going to happen, he actually saw it go down. Jesus saw the transaction. Listen to this in Luke 22, verse 60. It said, "Peter said, 'Man, I do not know what you're talking about.' And immediately while he was still speaking, a rooster crowed. And the Lord turned and he looked at Peter. And Peter remembered the word of the Lord, and he went out and he wept bitterly." According to verse 61, it says, the moment those words left his mouth, the rooster crowed, and the Lord turned, and he looked at Peter. Just happened to be walking by, and he turned, and their eyes caught each other. He locked in on Peter's eyes, and their gazes met each other right when it went down. So it's not like Peter did it, and Jesus will never find out. He's somewhere else. Jesus knew what he did. And Peter knew that Jesus knew, because they locked eyes. They made eye contact. And so Peter knew that Jesus knew that he had betrayed him. And that look right there, just that one look, must have destroyed Peter. And it did. It says he went out and he wept bitterly. Of course, the next day, if things couldn't get worse for poor Peter, the next day it gets much worse. Because Jesus is led to a cross and hung up on a cross to die with criminals. And so for Peter, at that point in his life, he realized that he's going to have to live with this, that he'd never have a chance to make that right with Jesus. He's going to have to live with that for the rest of his life, that failure. Now, I don't even know if we can begin to imagine what that must have been like for Peter. How do you recover from something like this, when you failed the Lord that badly? How do you begin to pick up the pieces? And how do you begin to even advance in your Christian life as a believer when you've messed it up this bad? Where do you go? How do you move forward? I'm going to give you the answer, and then I want to show you in the story. Here's the answer. Go ahead. By a living hope made possible through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead. That's how you move forward. And that's how Peter moved forward. So let me read the story, and then I'll show you a couple things here in the story, and then we'll apply it to our lives. The story, as I mentioned, is John 21. I'll have it on the screen, or if you have a Bible, you can follow along. But this is the last chapter of the Gospels. This is towards the end of his 40 days after Jesus' resurrection, this story takes place during that period. Listen to John 21. I'll begin at verse 1. It says, "After these things, Jesus manifested himself again to the disciples at the Sea of Tiberias. And he manifested himself in this way. Simon Peter and Thomas and Nathanael, the sons of Zebedee, and two others of his disciples were together. And Peter said to them, 'I'm going fishing.' And they said to him, 'We'll come with you.' So they went out and they got into the boat, and that night they caught nothing. But when the day was now breaking, Jesus stood on the beach. Yet the disciples did not know that it was Jesus. So Jesus said to them, 'Children, you do not have any fish, do you?' And they said, 'No.' And he said to them, 'Cast the net on the right-hand side of the boat, and you'll find a catch.' So they cast, and they were not able to hold in because of the great number of fish. Therefore, that disciple whom Jesus loved said to Peter, 'It's the Lord.' And when Peter heard that it was the Lord, he put his outer garment on, and he threw himself into the sea. But the other disciples came in the little boat, for they were not far from the land, about 100 yards away, dragging the net full of fish. When they got out on the land, they saw a charcoal fire already laid, and fish placed on it, and bread." Verse 12. "Jesus said to them, 'Come and have breakfast.' And none of the disciples ventured to question him, saying, 'Who are you?' knowing that it was the Lord. And Jesus came, and he took the bread, and he gave it to them, and the fish likewise. This is now the third time that Jesus was manifested to the disciples after he was raised from the dead." So that's the record. What I'd like to do is give you three principles of what it means to have a living hope. And I'll confess that none of these principles rises to the level of being an indispensable principle, because we all know there's only one of those, right? For crying out loud, we know that by now. So we're going to call these three super-duper important principles of what it means to have a living hope. I'm going to share the principles with respect to Peter and his life, and then we'll apply it to ourselves at the end of the message. So here are the three principles. Number one, Peter's past was the past, and Jesus was unfazed by it. I don't have time to get into it or to prove it to you, but there's so much in this story that stirs up the memories and the feelings of the past for Peter and the disciples. If you remember back in Luke chapter 5, when Jesus first called the disciples to be disciples, the circumstances of that story and that calling were very similar to what we just read. Peter and his friends had gone out fishing. They fished all night, they worked hard, and they caught nothing. Some guy is on the beach. Some guy is on the shore, and he gives them instructions about where to cast the net. They cast the net, and sure enough, fish start jumping in the net, and they're filled with fish. And that's how they started their journey with Jesus, just a few years prior. And now here we are, a few weeks after Easter, and it feels like for these disciples, they're starting all over again. I can imagine as these things are unfolding, someone realizes, or as these things are happening, "I've seen this movie before. I remember this." There's something familiar about all this situation. It seems that John, the disciple, is the first one to kind of clue in on what's going on. Listen again to verse 6. Jesus said, "Cast the net on the right-hand side of the boat, and you'll find a catch." So they cast, and they were not able to haul in because of the great number of fish. Therefore, that disciple whom Jesus loved said to Peter, "It's the Lord." I've seen this before. I know who that is. That's him. Now, when Peter heard this word, he got so excited, so worked up, that he threw himself into the sea and began this mad dash to the shore, one of those half-swim, half-run mad dashes to the shore about 100 yards away. Like a madman, he comes rushing in. But when he gets to the beach, his heart must have sunk in his chest when he saw what he saw. Look at verse 7 again. The disciple whom Jesus loved said to Peter, "It's the Lord." And when Peter heard that it was the Lord, he put on his outer garment and he threw himself into the sea. But the other disciples came in the little boat, for they were not far from the land, about 100 yards away. And when they got out on the land, they saw a charcoal fire already laid and fish placed on it and bread. Now, I mentioned earlier, make a note of the charcoal fire, because there's two places in the New Testament that a charcoal fire is specifically mentioned. One is here on the beach with Jesus and the disciples. Where is the other one? The night he betrayed him. Never heard of the guy. Don't know what you're talking about. So picture this scene if you can. Peter, so excited, comes rushing in. Madman comes rushing in, half swim, half run, soaking wet, out of breath, comes walking up onto the beach. And what's the first thing he sees? There's Jesus warming himself by a charcoal fire. You got to be kidding me. Of all the things he could have seen, his heart must have sunk. Those wounds, those memories were still fresh in his mind. I can't believe this is happening. But it's interesting and instructive to note that Jesus doesn't make one mention of Peter's failure or his treachery. Not a single word is mentioned about what happened. You can look it up. Instead, Jesus very naturally, very casually receives them onto the beach, and he begins to strike up a conversation as if nothing had gone down. Nothing had happened. But the point I'm trying to make is that Peter's past is not even a topic of conversation for Jesus. It's not a source of discomfort or awkwardness or bitterness, at least not for Jesus it wasn't. The fact is, Jesus is comfortable with Peter's past. And he who has ears to hear, let him hear what I'm going to say next. Not only was he comfortable with Peter's past, but he's comfortable with Peter with respect to his past. In other words, he doesn't have any problem being with Peter, being in his presence, despite what has gone down. And I think that's part of the point of Jesus setting up this scene with the charcoal fire. I don't think any of us would think that Jesus did that to embarrass him or to humiliate him or to stick it in his face about his failure and what he did. We know that because that's not who Jesus is, right? That's not what he does, or that's not who he is. But I believe he lit that fire and created that scene to acknowledge the past, that the past is there, but to do it in such a way that Peter would have the assurance that his past is the past, that his past is over. It's done. His sins have been forgiven. That's over with. And however ugly or messed up the past may have been for Peter, and it was. It was an ugly past. It didn't hinder Jesus in the least. It didn't slow Jesus up. Jesus wasn't freaking out about his past. It didn't faze him. Didn't make him uncomfortable or awkward or distant or aloof or standoffish or any other word you want to come up with. The past didn't repel Jesus from Peter. And that's an amazing thing. By some strange mystery, it was actually the opposite of that. We think the past serves as a repellent, that it's going to drive Jesus away. But somehow, in some mystery, the fact that Peter is a stumbling, bumbling, fumbling Christian, the fact that he has a past is not a repellent, it's actually a magnet. In some weird way, it actually draws Jesus closer. It brings him closer to Peter. And that's a hopeful thing. And it must have been a hopeful thing for Peter that night, that Jesus wants to draw close, that there's still hope. And so that's the first principle of a living hope. Go ahead, Nathan. That Peter's past was the past, and Jesus wasn't fazed by it, not even a little, unfazed completely. There's a second principle, and it has to do with the present. Here's the principle. At any moment, Peter could have fellowship with Jesus Christ. It was an open invitation. In the story, the disciples approached Jesus on the beach, and Jesus did what they often saw him do when they walked with him, and that is he extended an invitation. Listen to John 21, verse 12. Jesus said to them, "Come, have breakfast." And none of the disciples ventured to question him, saying, "Who are you?" knowing that it was the Lord. And Jesus came, and he took the bread, and he gave it to them, and the fish likewise. The invitation here is pretty simple. Jesus says, "Come, sit down, kick up your feet, relax, let's have a meal together, let's enjoy this time together." And in the Bible, we call that fellowship. It's relationship. It's one of the most intimate things you can do with a spouse or a loved one or a friend or whoever, to sit down and enjoy a meal, to share that moment together. And that's what Jesus is doing with his disciples. He's inviting them to fellowship. I remember about a year ago, we've got some real good friends in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. And we went to visit our friends. We went to their church, which is this really interesting, unique church in the middle of Lancaster. And I happened to go there on a testimony Sunday. So people were getting up and just sharing about different things that were going on, different ministries and whatnot. And this Asian woman stood up. She was a widow. Her husband had died about 10 years prior. And she began to share about a ministry that she's had for the last 10 years. She opens up her home on every Friday night. She just opens the home. And immigrants, there's a lot of immigrants in Lancaster, they just come to her house and they have a meal and fellowship and whatever. And that's the ministry. It's just an open door policy on Friday night, and these people come. And as she's sharing, she said a couple things. One, she said, "I don't feel comfortable sharing the gospel." In other words, of what I'm trying to do here is teaching or preaching, that kind of thing. "I'm just not comfortable with that. I don't know how to do that. I'm not skilled. That's not my skill set. Can't do it. But I can cook. I know how to do that. And I can open my front door. I know how to do that." And I sat there and listened to this lady. I thought, what a ministry that is. To open the door for fellowship. What a ministry. Come on in. Have a meal. Sit down. And that's what Jesus was doing with the disciples on the beach that night. An open door for fellowship. Sit down. Kick up your feet. Let's break bread together. Let's have a meal. An open door for fellowship. And I want you to notice in the story how prepared Jesus was for this moment, because this is also important. Look at verse 9 again. It says, "They got out on the land and they saw a charcoal fire already laid, fish placed on it, and bread. When Peter and the disciples got to the shore, everything was prepared for them." In other words, Jesus had already done everything that could possibly have been done for them to have fellowship in that moment. There was nothing left undone. The fire was already lit. Fish were already placed on the fire. The bread had been prepared. All the preparations were made. Every detail had been worked out. But there was only one thing missing, at least from the perspective of Jesus. Anybody want to guess what was missing from Jesus' perspective? Anybody? Then the disciples, his people, his friends, someone with whom he could enjoy the meal together with, fellowship, that's what was missing. It was them. That's the only thing Jesus lacked, was someone he could share this meal with. And that must have been another hopeful thought for Peter, that Jesus is always prepared to meet. He's always ready. He's always ready and willing to have fellowship. It's an open invitation. Sit down. Have fellowship. Let's break bread together. Jesus is ready. And so that's another principle of what it means to have a living hope. Go ahead, Nathan. Not only is Jesus unfazed by Peter's past, but he's ready. He's prepared. And at any moment, Peter could have fellowship because it's an open invitation. There's a third principle of a living hope, and it has to do with the future. And as I said, it's not... go back, Nathan. It has to do with the future, and as I said, it's not the far-off, distant future, even though there is hope in that, but it's the immediate future. In other words, hope for tonight, for tomorrow, and the next day, next week, next month, and so on. I'm going to state the principle, and then I want to try to show you what I mean by it in the story, but here it is, that God doesn't have a shelf, and even if he did, Peter wouldn't be on it. Let me explain what I mean. How many of you have seen the movie Toy Story? Anybody remember that? Not Toy Story 12 or 13 or whatever we're on. The first one, the original, the best one. Right? Let's see if you remember this character. Anybody know this character? That's Wheezy, right? Wheezy was one of the characters in the story. He's a squeaky toy. That's his purpose. And somehow in the story, his squeaker gets broken. My squeaker's broken, right? And as a result of having a broken squeaker, he is relegated to a spot on Andy's shelf. In Andy's room, he's put up on the shelf, and there on his shelf, he collects dust. Because he's broken and kind of a useless, broken, forgotten about toy, and he just sits there on the shelf, and he just collects dust and is just there. Now, I use that as an example because there's a thought amongst Christians and a teaching that teaches actually a very similar message. And the idea is something like this. Now, I can't imagine family ministries or fellowships you come from maybe teach this like this, but here's basically the idea that if you screw up badly enough, if you fail the Lord and you mess up your life or you mess up somebody else's life or both, if you do something like that, God can forgive you. You still go to heaven. Maybe you can have, over time, you can restore your relationship with God. You can have a relationship with him. But in terms of your usefulness, in terms of God's ability to use you in his kingdom and what he's doing, he can't use you anymore. You've become damaged goods. You're broken. No longer worthy to be used. And by virtue of your failure, you forfeit the right to be used by God. He's going to put you on the shelf. And you should consider yourself lucky that you're on the shelf, that you're not kicked out of the house altogether, right? Be glad that you're at least in the room, you're on the shelf, but you're just going to sit there as far as ministry or anything useful. Forget about that. That ship sailed. You're just going to hang out with Wheezy. You and Wheezy just hang out on the shelf, run the clock out, collect dust, but God can't use you anymore. Now, I don't know if you've heard teaching like that or if you've felt that. I think as men, I have this idea in my head, we're all kind of wired to feel that. We do have feelings, Eli, right? It's true. That's what Mom keeps telling us. I don't understand it, but it's a separate story. Anyway, I think we're all kind of just wired that way, that when we fail and if we fail, that I'm useless. God is not going to use me. He'll use somebody else. I'm done. I'm up on the shelf, me and Wheezy. But let me just say this. If that were true, certainly Peter, of all people, would qualify and have earned himself a place on the shelf, if not the top spot on the shelf. After his treachery, think about that, his denial of the Lord. I'll never deny you. I would die for you. And then a couple hours later, never heard of the guy. Never bleepity bleep heard of this. Don't know him. Never heard of him. After that treachery, if there was a shelf, Peter would have earned a spot on the shelf. He deserved that spot. He would have earned that permanent place. But let's look at the story and see how the Lord handles this, because this is pretty interesting. I'm going to pick it up in verse 15. After they eat breakfast, Jesus starts a conversation. It seems that everyone's privy to it. I don't know. But he starts up a conversation with Peter. Let's see what the Lord does. John 21, verse 15. It says, when they finished breakfast, Jesus said to Simon Peter, Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these? And he said to him, Lord, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." And Jesus said to him, "Tend my lambs." For those of you keeping track at home, here's Jesus. That's one. Tend my lambs. Verse 16. Jesus said to him again a second time, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" He said to him, "Yes, Lord, you know I love you." And he said to him, "Shepherd my sheep." That's two. Now we can only imagine what's going through Peter's mind and his heart as Jesus asks him this for the second time. I think it's something like this. "Oh God, please don't ask me that again. Whatever you do, don't ask me that question. Anything else, we can talk about the election, Trump, or basketball, or the economy, whatever, the weather. Let's talk about fishing. I'll talk about anything. But please, the wounds are too fresh. It hurts too much. Don't ask me that question again. I can't handle it. It's too much." Verse 17. Jesus said to him the third time, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" And Peter was grieved because he said to him the third time, "Do you love me?" That's three. And you can almost feel the weight of it as you read it. When Jesus asks this question, Peter's shoulders slump over. His head just drops. "You're kidding me." He did it three times. Peter somehow, I don't know how, but somehow Peter gathers himself together. And he responds to the Lord a third time. Verse 17, Peter said to him, "Lord, you know all things. You know I love you." Jesus said to him, "Tend my sheep." I'll try to explain why, but for Peter, this would again prove to be a night never to be forgotten, but this time for all the right reasons, when he realized once and for all what it means to have a living hope, a complete and total restoration. And I think the Lord did it by using these three questions. Here's kind of how I picture it. Jesus said, "Peter, do you love me?" Peter says, "Of course, you know I love you." And Jesus says, "Tend my lambs." And Peter's thinking, "I know the light is not real good here. Do you know it's me? It's Peter here. It's me, Peter, the screw up. You know what I did back there. You understand what happened at that fire. It's me." And Jesus asked him a second time, "Peter, do you love me?" "Sure, you know all things. I love you. Of course I love you." And Jesus says, "Shepherd my sheep." Peter's like, "Wait a minute, I thought I was on the shelf. Me and Wheezy were out there fishing all night. We've been hanging out on the shelf. I thought I was done, man. I was on the shelf. I'm done. I'm just running out the clock. It's over for me. You sure you want me to do that?" And then Jesus a third time, "Peter, do you love me? Do you love me?" Peter says, "You know all things. I love you. Of course I love you." And I think on that third time when Jesus asked it, finally the light bulb goes off for Peter, and he realized what a complete and total restoration he had been given. That not only was his relationship with Jesus restored, but this, that God still had a plan for his life. That God still had a purpose for his life. That his life was not over. That he wasn't damaged goods or useless to be discarded into some trash heap or put on some dumb shelf. And I can't prove what I'm about to say, but I believe this with all my heart, that rather than being discarded in a trash heap, that maybe, just maybe, God, instead of casting him away, that God actually raised Peter up to a higher place than if he had never screwed it up in the first place. Can you imagine that? That he made him even more useful than he would have been had he not screwed it up. Now, don't ask me to explain that. And don't ask me to understand it. Ask Lex or Paul or Ed, somebody smarter than me. But I'm telling you this, that's the kind of grace that we're dealing with. It doesn't make one bit of sense. Doesn't make any sense at all. But the point is from this point forward, God used Peter in a very powerful way. You know his story from here. The stumbling, bumbling, fumbling Peter, who couldn't get anything right. God used him for the rest of his life. He used him as a powerful instrument for his purpose. And what an encouraging thing that was for Peter. So that's his story, or a little part of his story. But let me just kind of close the time here with a short application to our lives, and hopefully a word of encouragement to every man in here. It's a message of hope, or it's intended to be a message of hope, a living hope, which has been made possible for us through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead. I don't know all your situations, what your mental state is, where you are at this moment, but I want to share with you three things, which I'd ask you at least to consider the fact that this is coming from the Lord to you, three things that I think the Lord would have you hear. Here's the first. Go ahead, Nathan. I'll back up. All right, go ahead. I'm sorry. The first thing is that your past is your past, and Jesus is unfazed by it. In other words, whatever your past is, whatever it involves, it's over, it's done, it's finished, your sins have been forgiven. That's done, it's over with. Jesus is not sitting up there right now freaking out about the fact that you have a past. He's not fazed by it. He's comfortable with your past. And not only is he comfortable with your past, he who has ears, let him hear. He's comfortable with you, with respect to your past. It doesn't matter how ugly or how messed up the past may be. It doesn't hinder him in the least. It doesn't make him awkward or distant or aloof or standoffish or any other word you want to come up with. If anything, it's actually the opposite of that. The fact that you and I are a stumbling, bumbling, fumbling Christian, it's not a repellent for Jesus. If anything, it's the opposite. It's a magnet. It actually draws him closer to you. Can you imagine that? That it draws him even closer, and that's an encouraging thing. Here's a second encouraging thing, that at any moment, including this moment right now, even here as we speak, you can have fellowship with Jesus Christ. It's an open invitation. Just like he did on the beach that night, by virtue of his death and his resurrection, Jesus did everything that could possibly be done for you and I to have fellowship with him in this moment, right here, right now, April, whatever it is, 2024, that we could have fellowship with him in this moment. Nothing has been left undone. He's made all the preparations. Every detail has been worked out. Every I dotted, every T crossed. You want to know the one thing that he's missing, at least from the perspective of Jesus? Anybody want to guess? What's he missing? It's you. It's me. It's his people. Someone with whom he can sit down and have fellowship with and enjoy the meal together. It's his friends. Someone he can sit with and enjoy. But don't forget that the question is not, is he ready? Is he prepared to meet with you? The question is, are you ready? Are you prepared to meet with him? Am I ready? Am I prepared? And that's a different question altogether. But don't you ever question his readiness to meet with you. He is ready. He's prepared. At any moment, he's prepared. So consider yourself from this moment forward, consider yourself invited. He's opened the door for fellowship. You're invited. It's an open door. He is ready. He's prepared, and that's an encouraging thing. And that brings us to a third thing, and it's this, Again, I don't know where you are, what your situation is, but I think somebody or somebodies needs to hear this, that God doesn't have a shelf. And even if he did, you wouldn't be on it. And what that means practically is this. I don't care how badly you've screwed things up. I don't care how unworthy, how ugly, how twisted, how damaged goods you think you are, how worthless or whatever you might feel as far as your usefulness to him. Because there's only three questions that actually matter to the Lord right now. Three questions that really mean anything. And the order of the questions is important. Don't screw up the order because it'll mess the whole thing up. But here's the three questions that actually matter to Jesus. Do you love him? Do you love him? Do you love him? I tricked all of you. It's not three questions. It's one question. It's one thing. And the question has never been, are you good enough? Are you qualified? Are you deserving? Are you educated enough? Are you capable? Any of those things. That's not the question, because the answer to that is no, you're not. And neither am I. You know it, and I know it, and the American people know it, right? That's not a secret. You're not fooling anybody. Do me a favor real quick. We'll do an exercise here. Take a look to the brother on your right. If there's nobody there, look at me. And then take a quick left to the brother sitting on your left. And then look up here. Know this without a doubt, that you're just as screwed up as he is, right? You are just as messed up as that guy is. And that's not a secret. That's not a surprise. We've known that. In our heart of hearts, we've known the answer to that question. And that's not the question that matters. The real question, the only question that actually means anything, do you love him? That's it. And if the answer to that question is yes, then what I'm telling you is that there is no shelf. There's no shelf. And what that means practically is this, is that your life is not over. You're not done. You're not damaged goods. He's not going to throw you in some stupid trash heap or make you hang out with Wheezy the rest of your life and just run out the clock and collect dust. It's not going to happen. Instead, he's going to use you like he did Peter in a powerful way to reach your family and your friends, your coworkers and your neighbors. He's going to use you, the stumbling, bumbling, fumbling, whatever, to work out his purpose. And I can't prove this, but I believe it, that rather than discarding you, throwing you on some trash heap or putting you on some dumb shelf, rather than that, maybe, just maybe, he might take you and actually elevate you to a higher place than if you never screwed it up in the first place. Instead of demoting you, he's going to promote you. Make sense of that. Now, don't ask me to explain that one. Don't ask me to understand it. Ask Lex, ask somebody else. I don't understand it. But that's the grace that we're dealing with. And it doesn't make one bit of sense. But that's what he does. Who on this earth, besides the Christian, can fall upward? There's nobody. That's it. We're the only ones that fall in an upward direction, because that's the grace we've been given. I think about this in terms of my own life. Some of you here know me a little bit. Some of you don't know me at all. Very few of you know me well. And nothing personal, but that's by design. I like to kind of keep to myself. That's business. It's not personal. It's personal. I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding. No, I kind of like to keep to myself, whatever. But I'll let you in on a little secret. Right? If you want to know who the hot shot is up here talking to you, you want to know who I really am, I'm this guy. Never heard of him. Don't know what you're talking about. And I can tell you this, it's a lot more than three times. We'll just leave it at that. And so the idea that God could forgive me, and restore me to a relationship. That's an amazing thought, right? For which I am very thankful. But to take that a step further and to think for a second that God could use me in some way, the stumbling, bumbling, fumbling Christian, that he could actually use me as an instrument in his hand, and he can use you to work out his purpose in this world, that's almost too much for us to even understand. Too much to bear. But that's the gospel that we preach. And you think about that as you walk around camp and sip on your latte, foamy, foamy, whatever, this afternoon. But think about that, that God could use you. Right? Your head will explode. You start thinking about that too much. We're going to get charged an extra camp fee. Right? The head's exploding everywhere. We won't know what to do. But that's an amazing thought, that God can not only forgive and restore you, but then he can now use you to accomplish his purpose. And that is an amazing thing. And that's what it means to have a living hope. And that's what Peter discovered on the beach that night. And that's the hope that's available to every one of us in this room, a living hope made possible through the resurrection of Jesus Christ. A hope for our past, a hope for this present moment, right now, right here, and a hope for the future. Not just the long distance someday future, yeah, that's true, but it's a hope for tonight, for tomorrow, and the next day, and the next day, next week, and next month, and so on and so forth. A living hope made possible through the resurrection of Jesus. I'm going to end this message where I started. I want to quote a verse, and then Paul's going to close us in a song. But I'm going to end this with a verse from Peter. And of all the people, this had to be written by Peter. In light of what we've heard, listen to it again. 1 Peter chapter 1, beginning of verse 3. Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, who according to his great mercy has caused us to be born again, to come alive from the dead, to a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead. Amen? Amen. Amen. Paul.